it's difficult to know where they see the exit point coming, isn't it, really? I mean, it's pretty clear, I think, to almost everybody that they're now being far too cautious for far too long. And, you know, the what they won't do is to engage in a proper conversation in public about why. I think the reason, my take on it is that I think the reason is that they're enthralled to the precautionary principle, which is sort of better safe than sorry principle, which would be okay if it was true. But of course, if what you're doing is more harmful than what you're trying to prevent, it all becomes a bit of a nonsense.
Well, it does. And also, they seem to only look at one level of harm. You know, you've talked about the excess deaths in the video, many of which you can attribute not just to COVID, but to also people who are dying of loneliness, people dying because they can't get treatment for other problems. And in the end, they seem to only be looking at the harm caused by COVID rather than the harm actually caused by the lockdown.
Yeah, well, this has been a problem throughout, is that if the government's going to set itself up as the nation's doctor, they ought to follow medical principles. And one of the key, most basic medical principles is first do no harm. Mm. And the thing is, in order to do that, you have to do two things. First of all, you have to do a risk-benefit assessment of the treatment you're giving. And secondly, you have to look at what's happening in the round. So if you focus obsessively on one thing, which is COVID, and you ignore all other possible health effects and harms of what you're doing, obviously you won't get the right answer. And they've been doing that from day one, as you said.
Well, indeed. And so when you see Messrs Hancock, Dominic Raab, Boris Johnson and others talking about, you know, having to wait and having to see what the evidence is and check the data and all of that, they don't seem to have moved at all from what was set out back in January and when things could not have been more different.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, it's a good example, isn't it? The politicians doing exactly the opposite of what they're saying in public. So they told us at the beginning it was going to be data, not dates. And clearly what they meant is going to be dates, not data, because apparently the data completely support the initial timeline that they set and nothing can move them from that. Mm. So that's obviously incomprehensible and also another nonsense.
Yes. And what's your view overall of the virus? I've got a feeling, and I have nothing to back this up, which is in any way medical. You're in a former NHS consultant in pathology. I mean, my take on the virus is that it sort of does what it wants. And regardless of how we react to it, it moves either to the north of England, to the south of England, it goes to India, it goes to Germany, it goes to Italy. You know, new variants pop up from time to time. I'm not sure we've ever really been in control of it.
No, I think this is one of the myths of the modern world, this idea of control, that we can control everything that we want to. And in the same way that, we can't hold the tide back, or King Canute couldn't hold the tide back, and he seemed to be more aware of the real world than we are somehow today. there are things that we can control and there are things we can't control. We couldn't control the weather on the weekend. We could just react to it, and we can't control an airborne virus. I mean, these things spread, as you say, they spread in their own way. There's actually no evidence that social distancing or lockdown or masks really have that much effect on what this virus has done. If you look at the viral infection curves around the world and the infection rates, there's no correlation whatsoever between the stringency of lockdown measures and what the virus has been doing. The curves all look very similar. So what we can do, though, is we can change how we react to the virus. And obviously, in reacting to the virus, we can either be proportionate and sensible and live with it as best we can, or we can overreact and actually cause big harms by what we're doing. And unfortunately, it seems to me that we've gone the latter route during this entire 15-month period and caused a lot more harm. And the thing is, it's not just about deaths. I mean, the government has been obsessively focused on death numbers and publishing these numbers without context. But the point is, no medical decision is ever made without taking into effect quality of life. I mean, medicine is not just about saving life at all costs. It's about saving life in a way that gives people a decent quality of life. Well, and when you look at what's been done to quality of life over this 15 months, and you add that into the equation, it's perfectly clear that what we've done is much, much worse than letting the virus do what it would have done with sensible, proportionate measures.
Yes. And I think many of us had a great deal of sympathy with Boris Johnson and the government a year ago, because nobody really knew what was going on. You use a clip from him of him saying this is the invisible killer, the invisible disease. And people were genuinely scared that if they did mingle with too many people, something bad might happen. What's been the reality, though, is that we've learned an awful lot in the past 12 months. But we don't seem to be using that knowledge, knowing what we do. Because I think, again, we can say without any fear or favour, most of the deaths that were caused were in hospitals and care homes. Most of the people who died were over the age of 82. You know, we don't seem to have learned from any of this.
I think it's a problem for our society, because there's clearly a very dysfunctional relationship between science and medicine and politics. Mm. It's just not possible to get a sensible, reasoned debate out into the public arena. The government, I mean, it is a part of the human response to an invisible threat. I mean, other examples would be the the McCarthyite communist scare in America in the 1950s, yeah. Or scares about radioactivity. Somehow, when there's an invisible threat that people can't sort of put their finger on, they can't see, the risk of hysteria and the risk of overreaction is much greater, because obviously it's difficult to know when it's there and it's difficult to know when it's gone. I mean, a key thing, as you say, is the death age. The average age of death from COVID is higher than the average age of death from all causes.
Right.
And what that means is really, mainly, it's killed elderly people with low life expectancy for various reasons. Obviously, a limited life expectancy is part of the human condition. We have to simply accept the fact that people do die. And what we're trying to do in medicine is to improve everybody's quality of life up to that point and then give people a dignified, calm, death as good as it can be for them and their families,
yeah,
without pain, and with dignity. And the point is to lose sight of that and simply preserve life at all costs and not count the effects on all the groups of people who weren't going to be affected by this virus is simply not medical and not scientific, in my view.
No.
And we haven't been allowed to debate this. But I think when the state tries to take control of a narrative to the extent that the government or governments around the world, not just our government, but governments around the world have done to this one, it does genuinely become quite an intimidating thing to go against. And, when the mainstream media, for example, and you've done a great job on talk radio, really trying to keep people aware of different views, excuse me, and the thing to understand is that science doesn't go forward by consensus. Science goes forward by argument and debate. And out of that argument and debate comes the right answer, or at least nearer the right answer. And so for the government to essentially prevent that sort of debate being held on mainstream broadcasters, I think to me speaks volumes about the security of their case. It seems to be quite obvious that if we have open debates about a lot of these points, the government's position on many things is untenable. And I mean, just to go back to a point you made just now about things that they've done well. The government, it seems to me, have done two things well during this pandemic. We did the Nightingale hospitals and built those very quickly, and we rolled out the vaccination program well. And although there are concerns about vaccination, which is a different story, nevertheless, the rollout of the vaccination program and the effect it's had has been good. But both times, the government hasn't known what to do with a good thing.
Mm.
So with the vaccination, this means that the pandemic has actually for some time now been over,
yeah,
in this country, and we should be opening up immediately. We should have opened up a while ago. That's what we would do if we went on the data, not the dates.
Yes.
But obviously, they're actually doing the opposite.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, how is it any safer to enter a pub and sit down on May the 17th than it is on May the 5th? I mean, it doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, it doesn't make any sense, given that the number of cases have fallen dramatically and the number of deaths has virtually disappeared. As you said, one death yesterday. I mean, the fact is, with the amount of testing that we're doing, a huge amount of testing, and with the nature of this test, which is another whole thing to unpack, but with the nature of this test and the risk of false positive results, especially when the test is being done on a mass scale by untrained people, the fact is the risk is that the pandemic will apparently carry on, because these false positives, at a time when the virus numbers are low, will greatly outnumber the numbers of the actual real disease. So, right throughout this pandemic, what we've been witnessing and what we think we've been witnessing have been two very different things. And the government has taken very tight control of what they think we've been witnessing. But I'm afraid it just doesn't stand up to
no,
to proper scrutiny.
No, and I was saying to Julie Hartley-Brewer just before I started the show, that I was listening to an interview with Susan Michie, or Michie, whichever way you want to pronounce her name, who is not a scientist medically, who is a behavioural scientist, who was assuring the person interviewing her that COVID droplets hung in the air for hours inside buildings, right? Basically saying that if you walked into a room where somebody had COVID and who was speaking or shouting or singing, you were in danger of getting it. Now, on your video, you say that's not the case.
Well, I think the virus hangs around. I mean, you've got to remember that viruses have been around since the dawn of time, since before cells started forming in the mists of ancient,
yes,
history. So the fact is, we've always lived with viruses, and particularly respiratory viruses. They spread in the ways that they spread, and they're very good at hanging around in environments. And they're very good at getting into and binding to the cells and people that they need to bind to replicate themselves. And the fact is, they've done that throughout all history, even when human beings were much less populous than we are now and spread much further afield. So the fact is, viruses have been around, and they've been selected to survive. So I think they do hang around in the air. And that's the reason, excuse me, that is the reason why actually, a lot of these measures that the government introduced wouldn't really be expected to work, because actually they do hang around. And when we go in a shop after somebody else, even if we're walking a meter or two behind them, we are breathing the same air. And if we're going to be susceptible to a virus, we are going to breathe it in. And if we're going to catch it, we sort of probably will. Mm. Yes, there are effects on, you know, concentration, and yes, there are effects on proximity. But the real reason why we've never done this approach to any viral infection before in history is because the costs of doing so outweigh the benefits. That's the key thing. Mm. And that's the obvious equation that hasn't been properly discussed in public. I mean, it's clear that doing this is much worse than actually doing our best to shield the vulnerable and treating people as well as we can do. I mean, there are situations where maybe this thing would be justified, it seems to me, but only if the virulence of the virus was so high that it was going to kill half of us, like the plague or something. Mm. This is so far away from that. This kills maybe 15 people in 1,000, maybe 10 people in 1,000. And actually, those people are already old and quite ill and, you know, not long to live. That's the point. So it's not that we don't do our best for those people, but we shouldn't try and turn society on its head for a reason like that, it seems to me.
There are many people who might naturally be immune to COVID, and you can explain that for us if you would. But also the fact that some of these non-symptomatic, asymptomatic cases might actually be incorrect, that people might be being tested positive and the test might be wrong and they might not actually have it, rather than taking the view that they've got it but they haven't got any symptoms.
Yes, well, I mean, just to deal with that point first, I mean, the asymptomatic spread has been one of the pillars of the government policy. The idea that, you know, you can be completely well and not know that you've got COVID and yet spread it to other people has been one of the reasons for carrying on with social distancing and carrying on with lockdowns and so forth. But the fact is, there's very little evidence. In fact, there's not a shred of evidence, convincing evidence, to actually back that up. Mm. I mean, there are three ways in which you can be asymptomatic today and yet test positive. One is the fact that you're incubating the virus and you're about to come out with the virus in a day or two's time and become ill. Right. That's one. Well, those cases are very low now. The second one is that you have a test that gives the wrong results. You get a false positive test, so you don't have the virus in you at all. But the third, and by far the biggest group now, of people who are apparently asymptomatic but get a positive test, are people who've already got immunity to the virus. Mm. So the way our immunity to viruses works is with things called T cells, which are a type of immune cells in our body that sort of identify virally infected cells and kill them. But the point is, they can't identify virally infected cells and turn on the immune system to knock off the virus until at least a few cells have been infected. And those few cells are infected, they make the virus, and then our T cells spot them, become activated and sit on them. But because the PCR test amplifies the RNA or the DNA of whichever virus it's trying to identify, you can still test positive when you've got a very, very low viral dose and those few cells have been infected. The third thing is that if you're immune, you can still test positive because of these few cells that have been infected, and yet you will be asymptomatic. You won't know that you've got the disease, and you will be no risk to anybody else. Mm. And so, as I say, the pillar of asymptomatic spread is actually got very low, as far as I've been able to find out about it, has got very low proper scientific backing and good reasons why it's actually wrong, like it would be wrong for most other viral infections. So COVID, the real lesson from all this is that COVID is not a virus unlike any other that we've ever seen. It's a virus like many others that we've already seen. Mm. It's not Ebola disease. It's not the plague. It's actually a fairly run-of-the-mill, quite nasty, but fairly type of respiratory virus that we're used to seeing and dealing with. Yes, it causes a wave of new death because it's a new virus, but that wave is not actually out with the range of death that you'd expect to see in a bad flu season. And the reason why it seems bigger is because we've attributed a lot of deaths on the basis of testing to COVID, which probably aren't due to COVID.
Well, I think that's absolutely right too, because when we hear people say, oh, but we've had this terrible death figure, yes, it has been a terrible death figure. However, it still hasn't been as bad as people are making it out to be. And as you say, some of those deaths may not be properly administered by death by COVID anyway. But the other question that nobody seems to ever talk about is how many people actually survived COVID. How many people who did get it, even who went into hospital with it, most of them survived.
The thing to understand is that with viral diseases, there are two, especially respiratory viral diseases, there are two ways that you can die, essentially, or that people most commonly die. One is because the virus is so virulent in you, it overwhelms your lungs and you can't breathe and you die because of that. But secondly, it's because the virus damages your lungs, and that gives the opportunity for other bacteria to get in and cause a chest infection, a normal type of chest infection, a bacterial one, and then that kills you. Now, the point is that we can give pretty good supportive treatment for the viral damage, and many bacteria we can give antibiotic treatment to. So actually modern therapy is very good at tiding people over nasty viral infections. And in fact, that's one of the key differences between today and say the Spanish flu time, when a lot of people who got Spanish flu would have died by these other infections because there was nothing we could do because antibiotics didn't come along until the late 1940s. So the point is we're in a very different situation today, and actually supportive medical care is very good. So we can't save everybody, but we, as you say, we can save a lot. So it makes a lot of these infections actually less of a risk and less frightening than they would have been even 50 years ago.
Right. And just finally, if you were by some miracle invited into Downing Street to explain your point of view to Boris Johnson, what would you say to him today?
I think we should treat the people of this country like grown-ups. I think instead of trying to manipulate their behaviour by some psychological operations on television and the latest British shroud waving from India or Brazil or, you know, New York or wherever it happens to be today to make people do what we think they ought to do, I think the government should treat people like grown-ups. I think we should be people should be allowed to hear the full story. We should have it debated. And people should, as they normally do with their health decisions, make up their own minds about these things. And I think for many, many people, making up their own minds would be to live normally, because actually the risks of not doing so are greater than the risks of being so.
Yes, I think it's absolutely right. Brilliant to talk to you, Dr. John Lee. Thank you so much for coming on. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure. Former NHS consultant in pathology, one of the sole voices of sanity, it seems to me, in the midst of all of the insanity that's been going on, because one person was registered as having died of COVID yesterday.